Rain would certainly be welcome. It might help quell the questions about whether Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston is going too far.
If you don't mind, Premier, just generally speaking, this does seem to have been quite a flashpoint, in particular in conservative circles across Canada, with a lot of people saying that this is the first step in what governments will undertake as climate lockdowns.
I don't really have time for any type of conspiracy theories. We haven't had any rain in Nova Scotia since June. So the thoughts and opinions of people who haven't been in Nova Scotia, who don't know what it's like in Nova Scotia right now, who probably have never been in the woods in Nova Scotia in their life, the thoughts and concerns of those people are not a top priority for me right now. My top priority is just keeping Nova Scotians safe.
Meanwhile, across the country, Alberta's government is moving in another direction. It's planning to limit its own emergency powers through Bill 49. Part of that bill would force the province to jump through a few more hoops before imposing restrictions during emergencies like wildfires. Premier Danielle Smith says the bill is, quote, built on the principle of sober second thought, unquote, and would ensure that even under pressure, her government would prioritize individual freedoms. And this debate is also finding its way to Ottawa. Conservative MP Michelle Rempel-Garner said people who deliberately start fires should get more jail time. And she blamed the need for provincial emergency measures on the feds.
Whenever there's a major crisis, what the Liberal government has done by their inaction has conditioned Canadians to expect that the only response they can see out of their federal government is to restrict their movement.
Liberal MP Jessica Fancy is from Nova Scotia, where at least 35 people have been charged with violating fire restrictions this summer. She says the bans aren't about control, they're about getting people to work together to stay safe.
So I was walking to a farmer's market the other Friday and a car drove by me and flicked a cigarette out. So for me, it's always that 10% man. Unfortunately, we're having to do a larger demand because of the possibility of a few bad actors.
Okay, so wildfire prevention is getting political this summer, and you might have to just get used to it. This debate over government restrictions isn't likely to go away as wildfire season burns longer and becomes more destructive. So what could that mean to live with more fire and more rules more often? It's a question Eric Kennedy thinks about a lot. He's an associate professor at York University, and he studies how people behave and make decisions during emergencies. I asked him to explain this great line he has: fire is a people problem.
I think we often imagine wildfire to be something that we can solve with technology, if we have the right artificial intelligence, or if we just had enough water bombers. But fire is fundamentally a people problem. It's a values problem. It's a question of what we care about, how we prioritize it, and how we choose to come up with different creative solutions together. And so for me, that's a central part of all of the research I do, is trying to put the people back into fire and understand the social dynamics of this phenomenon that we see in the world.
And you say living with wildfire is about people and their values. So does it make sense to you then that politics is finding its way into the conversation about fire prevention?
Fire has always been political. It's not just a case of politics getting in there now. Fire has always been a political phenomenon. When we study wildfire, when we look at fire history, there have always been questions about whose values get protected, about what fires we choose to fight, which ones we don't, how we invest money in fire preparedness, fire response, fire recovery. And so fire is always and has always been a political question. But we also live not just in the Pyrocene or an age of wildfires, but also in an age where there's lots of political division and polarization and a very fractured media ecosystem with lots of misinformation and disinformation too. And all of those things collide with the phenomenon of wildfire, with how we shape fires and how fires shape us as people in society. And so it doesn't surprise me that we see these manifestations of the politics of fire and how fire affects our different communities.
You've done a lot of research into how and why decisions get made in emergency situations. Can you give us a bit of a sort of behind the scenes look into how governments weigh people's individual rights against things like fire danger.
So in general, emergency managers are always caught in this moment where you want to make decisions as quickly as possible so that you can protect people, protect properties, protect the environment. But you also are always cognizant as an emergency manager about the impacts of the decisions you're making. You know that these decisions have costs and consequences for people. And so these are not decisions that emergency managers are taking lightly. I think it's really important that agencies have a wide array of tools available in terms of education, asking for better infrastructure investment to reduce the risk in the first place, mitigation and preparedness measures that might help complement some of these restrictions. It's important to have that wide toolkit available.
Should politics play a role in this? I mean, you've been talking about agencies and managers. Should the politicians have any role in these kinds of decisions?
Yeah, as someone who is a sociologist of disasters, I'd say that's a really unsettled question. There isn't necessarily a right or a wrong answer. Some folks would argue that politicians should play a bigger role because they're the folks that we've elected. They have that democratic mandate, and so it's important for them to own those decisions. Others argue they should play a smaller role because we have technical experts who know what they're doing, right? Folks who are fire experts or flooding experts have a lot of experience, training, skills, science available to make these decisions. And so I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong answer objectively here. That's something that there's a lot of debate and contestation about. But I do think it's really important that we approach that question thoughtfully and that we're aware of the trade-offs when we leave one direction or the other.
Well, let's talk then about what happens once restrictions are already in place. When we look back at COVID, there was a lot of compliance at the start, but people we saw quickly started to get weary. As the climate changes, as we see restrictions on movement becoming more common during the summer, would you expect more pushback on things like hiking bans?
I do think that these are not always broadly accepted measures, and that's really understandable. When we think about emergencies and how we make decisions in emergencies, I think it's really important to be empathetic of where people are at. Because what's palatable for one weekend in a season might not be something that communities are really willing to live with for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks of the season. Just telling someone a rule, here, you can't do this, you have to trust us on it, is never going to go over well. And so there are lots of different intervention points that agencies can use to try to improve this.
Well, what about fines and punishments? Are those a good idea as part of a communication strategy to get big fines or some kind of punishment to get compliance?
At the very least, those can't exist in a vacuum, right? They can't be the only tool that's being used. And they have to exist alongside of the kind of trust building, for instance, that is required to get people to find these instructions credible in the first place, right? So I think some of the agencies, for example, that are investing in having staff out in local communities in rural areas full time, living there, building relationships, so that when a moment comes where there is a difficult ask that we have to make for public safety, that's coming from a familiar face, from a friend, from someone you trust. Same with accompanying some of these restrictions with education and explanations about why they're happening, right? Just giving a rule and saying, here's a fine if you don't comply, I think can be really challenging without people understanding why the rule's in place and why it's important that we take these measures. And as we deal with prolonged fire seasons, we might even need to look beyond rules too, right? Are there ways that we can make some of these outdoor activities safer through mitigation efforts, so that perhaps we can be a little bit less restrictive with the rural regimes by investing in some of the infrastructure and tending to some of the environments in ways that create safe places for fires or fishing so that we don't have to restrict those going forward.
You know, there's something that's just so Canadian about this drive to get outside as much as you can, especially in the summer. And I, you know, it's funny because the number of people who started going out into the woods or the forests or the mountains just rose exponentially during the pandemic of all things. But I'm wondering what you think the future of living with fire and fire prevention rules, what could that look like in this country?
Yeah, it's a great question. And people love Canadian landscapes. They love to be out in them. And there's a reason why people love living in places surrounded by trees and grasslands and all sorts of things that are flammable from a intellectual perspective, but are also the kinds of places that draw us in and where we want to live. So I think this idea of changing to a paradigm of living with fire is really important for a couple of reasons. One, we can't tell ourselves that we're going to be able to just eliminate fire, get rid of it, control it perfectly. And so we have to adopt this notion that fires are going to be like wind events, heavy rains, tornadoes, earthquakes. These are things we have to build for and accommodate in how we design.
What does that mean? What does that look like, building and accommodating and designing?
Yeah, so an example of this might be in how we build some of our homes, right? You might have heard of efforts like FireSmart, where we're changing the building materials that we're using. We're making sure that the vegetation around the house is resilient to fire, that there are defensible spaces. But I think we could extend some of those principles beyond just homes too. So we were talking a little bit earlier about these restrictions on hiking and fishing and being out in the environment. Well, we might need to ask the question of how can we look at our parks and design them in ways that allow for more engagement and for people being out there during periods that are higher fire risk, where we might have wanted to restrict that in the past. So maybe that's providing different ways of cooking or sites that are safer for people to be able to cook on. Maybe that's adjusting how we're looking at things like ATV usage, which can be a high risk for starting fires. Maybe we need to adjust our trails, adjust the vehicles themselves to reduce some of that risk so we can do those things safely as we deal with longer and longer fire seasons. So I think it's that resilience, that acknowledging that fire potential is always there and that we can't eliminate it. We have to mitigate its impact and reduce the likelihood of the adverse consequences.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens. Eric Kennedy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
What I find so interesting about this story is the idea that the people who are living through this, who are closest to the fire, are the ones who seem to, for the most part, support these kinds of restrictions. And I've kind of seen that over and over again in years of covering wildfire in different places, both in Canada and in other parts of the world. The people who are up against it, the people who are seeing it on the front lines, want to do everything they can to make sure no one loses their lives or their property if they can help it.